Welcome to Wrestling and Everything Coast to Coast with your host, Buddy Sotelo Esquire, and wrestling's premier photographer, Dr. Mike Lano. And we have a longtime guest that I can almost as equally introduce as you can, Mike, and that is the voice of All Pro Wrestling and many other Bay Area federations, and that is the great golden tones of Alan Bolte. Thank you for joining us tonight.
I'm looking forward. It's been a while. Dr. Lano, it's been a million years since I saw you.
Let me say this, because Russ initially tried, I think, the last 2 years to get you on. I gave you a holler. But Alan is one of my dearest good friends, true friend. We've never had a cross word since, 73, 74? He came in. Victor Berry left, but Victor was only doing the program for Roy Shire. Alan Bolte not only was ring announcer, but he also did the program, which I don't think anyone in any territory, other than Larry Matisick for Sam Munchnick in St. Louis, did.
Yeah, maybe Jeff Walton in L.A., maybe.
True, you're right. But you did not only commentary on TV at times when, Hank was off, Hank Renner, but the ring announcing at the Cow Palace and other venues, not just Crown Jewel, Cow Palace. With the golden tones, and no one else was writing the California Wrestling Report for Wrestling World Magazine but Alan Bolte.
Correct. Yeah, at one point I was writing for 9 wrestling magazines, Wrestling Confidential, Wrestling World, The Ring Wrestling, Wrestling Review, and doing all the programs for all the cities. So I started announcing for about a year and a half before Victor decided to move, and I took over the programs there. And I am proud to say that I made a lot of money in those days, believe me, especially for that time. Selling the program for $1 was quite a bit. Every battle royal at the Cow Palace, we totally sold out. I would sell about 3,500 programs at $1 a piece, so you can figure it out. And that went really well until Shire finally decided to kind of let it go.
Let me ask a question, and I'll throw right to Russ so he gets some time. I want to go, I know Russ probably was going to ask this, but I don't even know this. Tell us how you discovered wrestling, as a fan. And then I think you started working for the magazines, or how did you get hired by Roy?
Yeah, I wrote the first wrestling magazine. I did a story on Pat Patterson for Ring Wrestling. I was barely 16. I took some pictures at Channel Studio TV. I did an article, I sent it in, and they bought it. I remember getting a check for $50, which was a lot then, and I was very young. And I was always a fan all my life, a wrestling fan. I loved it. I never really wanted to wrestle. I really did want to announce. So having all that happen was just fantastic. I remember meeting Louis Miller, the local promoter. He had an event at the Richmond Auditorium, and the announcer did not show up. And Louis said, you're going to announce tonight. I remember it was superstar Billy Graham, Pat Patterson, and Ripper Collins in a 6-man tag. I just loved it. I did the whole show real well. I kept thinking to myself, I don't want this to end. Sure enough, Louis said, you're good. I'll put you in Stockton next week. And then when I was in Stockton, a couple shows later, Roy Shire showed up at the venue. And eventually he said, I'll keep you in mind, I'll put you in the Cow Palace if you're good. So then that happened. And then Victor with the programs, it all just escalated from there.
Go ahead, Alan.
I've known you, like you said, maybe I started announcing in 74. So I've known you that long. And you are the most recognized, the very best wrestling photographer /journalist/ historian. You have always been able to keep in touch with all the big name wrestlers all throughout the years, and I'm glad you're doing well and really
well. I totally miss the Bay Area. I feel my presence up there with Russ, we could get our Golden State Warriors to win on the road. It seems to be ping-ponging. I don't know how, maybe Russ and I can get into that later, how the Lakers got to start home game, game one, which they of course won in game three. So it seems to be home field advantage for our Warriors. But Alan, before I throw to Russ, did you have any ring announcing or vocal training? How did you know that was going to be your gift and your passion?
Believe it or not, no. It a voice is something you either have or you don't. You can practice it. You can take lessons. Same thing with a singer, a dancer. Either you have to have a little bit of rhythm in your body. You're born with it, or you're not going to be a singer or a dancer. And I think kind of the same thing with announcing. Practice, yes, but it's got to be something inside of you, and not everybody has it.
Well, that's amazing.
No formal training, no.
So the one thing that unites us all is the memory of Roland Alexander.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And All Pro Wrestling. So can you tell me how you got connected with All Pro Wrestling?
I met Roland. He would hang around. When I started announcing, he would hang around the Cow Palace, San Jose. He knew Dave Meltzer. I mean, there was just a click there. Steve Pardee, Eddie Giovanetti, they all ended up breaking into business eventually. But remember, in those days, it was very kayfabe. In fact, I announced, it was a year and a half before Roy would even have me come up to the dressing room to get my instructions. It was that kayfabe. And finally, Louis Miller said, he's smart already. He loves the business. He's not going to hurt it, you know. So, and they didn't want people like Roland or Eddie, or any of those guys. He was afraid that they were kind of marks, that they would hurt the business, which was the opposite, not at all true. So then when Roland started his training camp and then started doing live shows, there I was. And I told Roland, I can't announce all of these shows. I have a real estate broker. I own an office. I've got other stuff too, but I sure would love to announce once in a while when I can. And Roland did very well for a long time with his shows, you know, all over Northern California. And Mike, you and I did a couple shows with him two or three times, and we were all really saddened when we lost Roland. Here's somebody who loved the business from the day he was born, and he kept saying, I want to get in this business somehow. If it's a wrestler or a promoter, or somehow I want to get in this business. And he did, and he deserved it.
He learned how to take bumps and stuff, as Russ knows, but he also was kind of an expert who I would go to. You know, whatever knowledge I have, I picked from, you know, friends like Roland or Eddie Moondog Moretti, one of the nicest guys the planet.
Yeah,
nicest guy. And I remember towards the end, you and I were on tons of Roland shows, and you would always, whether it was a Kirk White or a whoever you were ring announcing, you would always point me out at ringside, which was nice. I appreciate it. But Roland was an expert on roller derby, and because I was allowed, you know, my primary home base was Los Angeles for LaBelle, and I started flying up before I could even drive. And Dave Meltzer and his mom, he couldn't drive either. We were too young, early 70s, for Roy's bigger shows like the Battle Royals, et cetera.
Right.
But I went to San Jose Civic first for a Swensky show.
Yeah.
It's policeman. Before I went to the Cow Palace one, but I would come up there. Meltzer and his mom would pick me up. I would stay overnight. They'd take me to the airport to the next day. But Roland was an expert on the classic roller derby, the more athletic San Francisco-based Jerry Salzer. Yeah. Whereas my primary home base, shooting for the program in LA, which is where I started working for all the magazines. Mine was Roller Games, and when Jerry Salzer. So, Alan, let me ask, were you into or involved? You know, they seem to be, you know, roller derby, roller games was like wrestling on skates, high speed.
Yes.
Were you also into that? Because there seemed to be a total crossover, particularly in Northern California.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, remember Walt Harris was the TV announcer for both wrestling, National All-Star Wrestling, and roller derby. They had roller derby every Sunday night, Kezar Pavilion. Channel 2 would film it. Every Friday night, wrestling at KTVU in Jack Lemmon Square, Oakland. And the funny thing, wrestling and roller derby were huge at that time, and they would pack every arena, and they would all go to the same venues, Cow Palace once a month, Sacramento Auditorium every couple of weeks, San Jose, Stockton, Santa Rosa, and they both were drawing very well, and it wasn't like they really competed. The fans seemed to come out all the time regardless. It was very exciting on TV before KBHK TV 44, before Shire lost Channel 2, and then it grabbed 44 and Hank Renner in Sacramento, Channel 40 and all that. And
you know the story of that, because I really prayed and hoped you would have come to some of my TV show, This Is Your Life things, because I did a number of them for Walt Harris, as yes. well as the one I did with Roy and Hank Renner. But yes. Walt, when Roy got kicked out of Channel 2, whatever year that was, 1969, 70, for continually right. spinning on the floors after his cigar juice, after being totally warned repeatedly, do not do this yeah. or you're done here. And then he has to scramble, and he gets, you know, the only TV he could film is in lowly Sacramento, whereas Channel 2 was the premier non-network yeah. it's been the whole Bay Area, Northern California. He's stuck going up there. Walt Harris told him, I'm not driving from, you know, his home was like
San Jose, I think.
Yeah, even further, like Los Altos or some okay. really Los Gatos. It was Los Gatos, really yeah. expensive there. He goes, I'm not driving all the way up there because I have too many roller derby commitments. And right. so that's how Hank Renner got into the picture. A thing that few people know, and I don't know if I've told you this, Alan, you may have already known, Hank Renner's middle name was Gearhart or Kaiser, one or the other. Huh. And when Gary, you know, it was Gearhart because Gary Kaiser, when he became Gearhart Kaiser, took Hank's middle name. That's where that came from because it yeah. sounded perfect to manage the Von Brauners and Von Steigers as a German heel. And yes, the TV show for the first 7-8 years, although I had Annie Calvello co-host it with me when Gary Gearhart Kaiser, Roy's, you know, longtime heel lead manager, Russell appreciate that. Had to move away. He was searching the whole country for his ex-wife. So he moved to Indianapolis from California and then Florida. But so then Annie Calvello, who was like the Fabulous Moolah of Derby, 7-decade skater, total great talker, only one of a kind. Yeah. We all loved and yeah. miss Annie Calvello. And the weird thing was Annie, so she would set up and bring all the Derby people for me, and I would have all the wrestling people. And she told the story when Pepper brings in Bonnie, his last wife, of how they had an affair in Honolulu, because in December of 73, Derby had tours of Japan and Honolulu, and Roy sent a bunch of wrestlers like Pat, of course, and yes. Pepper to Honolulu for Ed Francis, because there was a long time working relationship, Roy Shire, San Francisco. I don't know if he had part ownership for a little while until Blair's might have bought him out, but he was sending wrestlers to Honolulu, and Derby is there, and Annie Calvello from Derby and Pepper Gomez, one of the top wrestlers in the whole world, had this affair there while he was married. And so she sputs that, but then she also told us how Jerry Selzer, who they were all pissed at, and this was a dignified guy who founded Bass Tickets.
Oh, yeah.
Multi-millionaire before he died. Yeah. But Jerry Selzer pulled the plug on the classic Charlie O'Connell, Annie Calvello, Joni Weston, Jan Vallo, et cetera, roller derby, December 73 after the Japan and Honolulu tours, saying that it just wasn't profitable any longer. And so a lot of those skaters, most notably Joni Weston and Ann Calvello, had to go to the more theatric roller games, my home base in L.A. And that's where I first met Joni Weston and Annie Calvello, who I was, you know, lifelong friends with, like you. And
do you remember, Mike? I think you were at the Cal Palace, I think. Ann Calvello showed up in the crowd, and the word got back, and we asked her to come back to the back dressing room area, and I was going to give her a quick shout-out. We have a special star here in the crowd tonight. Wow. World Derby Superstar. And she told me, Ann told me, remember, I'm the one who started the orange hair, the purple hair, the yellow hair. Nothing to do with Dennis Rodman. I started it long ago, and he stole it from me later.
I constantly said that on TV. She used to have, like, when Elvis was big in 56, 57, 58, she would have a guitar on, you know, a drawing of a guitar painted on one side of her head, and then a silhouette of Elvis's head profile on the other side. She was way ahead of it. Yes. Russ, I can't tell you what a unique, and she loved wrestling. Anytime I would try, when Kirk White started having his early little mini fan fests, there were signings, the first few of them, and I'm not trying to put any credit on him, but I did nag him to give free dealer tables to Ann Calvello from Derby, from wrestling, Pepper Gomez and Kenji Shibuya. And my wife and I would drive Kenji and Pepper there. as well as Fritz von Goring, the original Paul Diamond. These are all wrestling legends. Annie knew all of them, as did most of the other skaters. So when I did those, This Is Your Life, Walt Harris, again, Russ Royce, very first wrestling announcer. Yeah. He did all of it. But he also did it with Pepper Martin doing Pepper color. Martin. The very first guy doing color commentary in the entire world for wrestling was Pepper Martin, another friend of ours.
Yeah. And just they were good. Pepper and Hank.
I got to tell you, about a year ago, Pepper called me and he said, Mike, I'm on hospice care.
Oh.
And he knew he only had a few weeks to live. And I was close with this guy. When he wrote his book, he sent me the draft to proof and put photos in it. And when Lou Thesz wrote his own book, I forget if it was called Hooker, he sent it to Pepper to proof, it, you know, on his end. So Lou trusted this wrestler who became a top, top actor, director, screenwriter. Oh. I mean, Pepper was massive in Hollywood, just on the likes, you know, similar to H.B. Haggerty, Hard-Boiled Haggerty, Russ. So we have all of these fantastic people in our Bay Area, more so than even Hollywood, you know, where I'm living until I moved up, lived 40 years in the Bay Area, moved back. So, Russ, let me throw back to you.
Oh, okay. You are going so far memory lane there, that, you know, before I was ever born, it's kind of hard to make
it. But you appreciate it, Russ, because I know you love your Bay Area wrestling history.
I do.
And it was so cool. I got to tell you.
You've had some time there. I wanted let's talk to our guest here and have our guest tell you a few things about his experiences. So when you got into All Pro Wrestling, that was like when? Like the mid-90s?
That's a good time, yeah. And then, Roland was around all, like Mike, Roland had been attending all the events since he was young as well and knew all the history. Knew everything that was happening.
Now, Roland didn't start doing shows. He did the school 94, 95-ish. So his first show was either late 96, early 97 in Modesto. I was there because Roland had a guy dress up in a white doctor's suit, a heel manager. He called him by my name. But more notably was some fan threw a brick through the car, and it hit Chris Cole in the head. I think it was Chris Cole, if you remember that. The windshield. Chris Cole, not Chris Colt. Oh. One of Roland's wrestlers, he had the Cole brothers.
Okay. Yeah.
Us might remember Chris Cole, and he got injured pretty badly, and his brother did too. So, and they were baby faces. They weren't even heels. So that was Roland's first show. So Alan started as a ring announcer, I'm guessing late 97. He had somebody else do it at first, but then he went to the best in Alan Bolte later.
Thank you. Yeah, and he ran a lot of towns. He had Hillsburg going, Santa Rosa, Vallejo. VH1 recorded part of for a documentary they were doing. They were recording stuff, a documentary on Andre the Giant, and they interviewed me for my experiences with Andre. Andre was in my house in Albany, Berkeley, years ago. Pat was over there. I remember one time we called for pizza. I was maybe 18, still living with mother in Albany. We called for pizza. The pizza guy looks in the house, points over to Pat and says, "You're Pat Patterson, the wrestling champion." And Pat says, "You know, who the hell is that? A lot of people say that about me. I don't know who he is."
Yeah. And what was it like having Andre the Giant in your house?
Well, he bent over quite a bit. You know, he was a super nice guy, as everybody knows. And he picked up the tab wherever he went. Whenever Roy could bring him in for the territory, every single arena was packed. I mean, he was huge. But I know that he was hurting, being so tall, so big, even on a plane, even on first class, a king-size bed, his feet would hang over. So he was always really hurting quite a bit. And I think that his activity in wrestling helped, you know, helped keep him going, because we sure lost him. He was very young.
Yeah, it wasn't too long ago that actually happened. So tell me about some of the stars that you saw come up in wrestling at All Pro Wrestling, and who were some of your favorites to work with?
He had a lot of real good talent. What about the great Khali? I think there was confrontation.
Dalip Singh was the name that he used, his real name then.
Well, there's no question he did get his training from Roland, and there was this big fight about should Roland get his percent or not. he definitely worked for Roland for a long time, did some of the live shows. He was huge physically, and he was, he didn't speak English much, but he was learning. There was a big name. He had a couple guys with hoods. I can't quite remember their name, but they were very good. Mike Modest, of course, was tremendous. I always told Mike, he just like Ray Stevens. I mean, yep. His moves, his yep. looks. And then there was big Mike Diamond. Those
Max,
guys
Max
were
Diamond.
All.
Max. Yeah.
Well, Max yeah. Justice was another name, but he was initially billed as Mike Diamond. He wrestled as Mike Diamond for a couple of years, Russ.
Yes.
And okay. he turned into Max Justice, you know, about, say, 1999.
Yes.
Was that? And Steve Rosano, the Gigolo, and Vinny Massaro, right. who's a ref. Roland had him as a ref for a year and a half before he even allowed him in the ring. And then he was a little Dick Grimes, you know, with a hood on, the team uh-huh. with Vic Grimes.
You
so he
also,
had
you're
so
also
much.
Vallejo for when XPW came up. And that brought up guys like, you know, the Prototype, who, of course, is yes. later going to be John Cena and Samoa yeah. Joe and Frankie Kazarian. And Looney Lane, and we had, you know, those XPW stars come yeah. up there, and you did the.
It was a nice feud, you know. It was a better feud than, not because Roland did anything wrong, because Roland tried to make those two feuds that fizzled with BTW work, and it was because Kirk White was just too lazy, but because Rick Bassman of UPW in Irvine, Southern California, Orange County, right near me. Was a student of the game like Roland and loved the biz, loved MMA. He made sure it worked. There was a lot of nice involvement between the two promotions, UPW and APW.
Yeah.
And culminating in that first King of the Indies, 2001, Spanky, I mean, literally everybody. Cena was already gone to OVW, but Samoa Joe and Keiichi Sakota came up as a tag team, but Samoa Joe
was a big part of that first.
Yeah, Samoa Joe worked for Roland quite a bit. Volcano.
But Chris Daniels was already coming up regularly, but he was then part of UPW with Frankie Kazarian. They weren't teaming yet, but they came up again. Spanky Brian Kendrick, who's tremendous talent. We had and Scrap Iron.
Adam Pearce.
Yeah, Adam Pearce, who's a WWE. quote-unquote official, whatever that means. They're doing a bang-up job, but, I mean, all of us were friends, and UPW had tremendous talent, APW had tremendous talent. And
it's nice to see some of the younger guys really make it in the business. It's so good to see somebody who just loves the business. What's his, L.A. Knight, he used to work as Eli Drake.
Yes.
He did a lot of stuff for Kirk White and some of the others. Frankie Kazarian. It's nice. Brian
tremendous
Page.
Talent.
Yeah, it's nice to see them make it the big time. L.A. Knight is definitely a hell of a worker, and he's definitely big in WWE, and I'm glad for him. They all took their bumps. They all drove 3 hours to wrestle for $50. I mean, they all did that, and now it's paying off.
So tell me about, like, some of the interesting challenges that come, because my brother also did announcing, too. For my California Championship Wrestling. And so, you know, he's part of that. And I had to do it for a couple of matches. And, you know, for me, even though I do promos all the time, doing announcing as a ring announcer is a different sort of character than when you're trying to be a manager and insult the crowd. So tell me about some of the nuances about
I remember the first time I ever announced at Cal Palace, my uncle bought me a real nice kind of a tuxedo suit. And everybody kept saying, don't be nervous, don't be nervous. There's about 12,000 people in the palace. Patterson was there, Shibuya, as Shibuya toward the end. But I loved it, and I really wasn't nervous. I mean, I had my notes. You look out at the crowd, and you see, you know, way up in the balcony. But bigger concern is, you know, would I trip over the rope, or would I drop my cards, or... But, you know, Roy was pretty hands-on with his instructions, you know, and you didn't dare fuck up. I remember one time only, I guess I did a major fuck up, and did he get all over me? Baldy, I fly Mighty Igor into the Cow Palace, and you call it a fucking semi-main event. It's first main event, second main event, third main event bold man. Don't ever do that again. It's like, okay, Roy, I get it.
Let me ask you, Alan, before I lose this train of thought, again, what I was about to say earlier was I remember Meltzer would be sitting there taking notes. So I'm shooting ringside, and our Eddie, you know, Moondog Moretti, Giovanetti, would be sitting there with Roland. But often they would stand in the back of the Cow Palace. They're trying to pick up girls while watching wrestling. So they're like multitasking. But Roy was unique, and the only promoter I know who was ahead of his time before what we call some of the freak show MMA companies, which is where Dilip Singh ended up. Roland wanted his cut. They brought him to Japan and then CMLL Mexico for wrestling. But Japan initially for the MMA, and where they were just looking for freakishly big or different guys. So Roy, for his Battle Royals only, I think at one of them, he had Andre Haystack Calhoun, who was billed as 601 pounds, but the McCreary twins, Roy was like the major promoter using the Guinness Book of World Record heaviest twins ever. They were like 640 and 640.
The McGuire ones, yeah.
Yeah, and so you have Andre, you have Haystack, occasionally Man Mountain Mike coming up from L.A., who was actually heavier than Haystack, and the McCrearys. And I just thought all of them in one battle royal, that's no promoter was doing that. I mean, would alternate. We never had Andre and Haystack in the same battle royal. Roy did.
I remember that. I think that was, would you think that was maybe 78? 70?
No, it was before, maybe 78 or 75, because the 76 one was the one that Fuji won.
Okay.
And I think the one after was the one Morocco won, which was a terrific battle royal.
Yes.
I mean, Roy's, as great as Roy's cards were, the Battle Royals were special. He was the only promoter who put the Battle Royal on first, which is why Roland copied that. And the reason for that, I finally asked him, and Roy said, well, a lot of the guys are doing me a favor, like Bruce or Brody coming into Roy's second to the last Battle Royal. Brody only agreed to come. He's on his way to Japan, so he said, if I can be on first, I can zoom to SFO to hit the thing to Narita Airport in Tokyo. And that's why Roy had that on. And then he would sort of lie. We'd have these incredible matches advertised. Hardly any of them would occur because many of them, like the Funks, would have to go to SFO Airport to go to Japan. And then Roy would just have you announce, XYZ got injured. They won't be in the matches. We've had to change some of the matches.
Right.
One of those, though, I was advertised, and we're going crazy. Sheik against Dory Funk Jr., but that had to be scrapped. Sheik, I think, no-showed, and Dory had to go to the airport, so we didn't get.
Mike always was able to get the inside scoop.
But you remember, though, the last Roy Shire Battle Royals, the main event. So the opener was the Battle Royal. The main event would be Harley Race defending the title against Chavo Guerrero. And then the next second to the last one against Ray Stevens, the only time Ray ever got an end of a title match. And the last and very last Battle Royal, Pat wins. And then in the main event, he goes against Harley for a terrific, terrific NWA title match. That was Pat's also, like Ray the year before, his only NWA world title challenge to any champion. Amazing. Yeah,
I saw myself on YouTube when Ron Starr was the Battle Royal winner. That was that maybe his second to last?
I think that was like 77 or 78.
Okay.
78 because 77, I'm pretty sure, was Morocco. Okay. 76 was Fuji.
Well, remember the big scandal, and I've been asked on other shows about this, with Fuji and Teru Tanaka. The strange thing, I knew nothing about anything. Roy didn't say anything in the dressing room. I don't know what,
Russ doesn't know this. For some reason, Alan, you might know, Fuji was U.S. champion, couldn't make it. So Toru Tanaka is longtime Tri-WF partner for Vince Sr. Toru Tanaka is, semi-main eventing for us in L.A. Roy asked for him to come up, and he puts a mask on him, and they call him Fuji. Alan, take it from there.
So what happened, Fuji and Roy got in a big fight, I think about a week earlier, and Fuji left the whole territory. So this was, it was already filmed Monday night at Channel 40. They taped Monday night for the Saturday Cow Palace. So the taping was done. It was Fuji title match. Fuji's gone. The only guy he could get was Tarō Tanaka, who really did not look like Fuji. Fuji was taller.
No, not at all.
Fuji was a little, I think Tanaka was a little huskier. So as soon as this guy gets in the ring and I introduce him as Fuji, Roy didn't say a thing to me. So I think he really kind of wanted to kayfabe it, like this was a last minute, I had no choice kind of thing. And fans are yelling and fans are coming up to me at the timekeeper table. Oh, and security saying, you got to get back. And they're saying, that's not Fuji. Tell him that's not Fuji. And I'm looking like, you know, I don't know.
But he got into a lot of trouble with the commission for that. Instead of, why wouldn't you just say Tanaka is taking his place, Fuji's injured or something?
Well,
because everybody knew they were this major two-time, before the Usos became the longest tag champions, Tanaka and Fuji were the greatest Vince Sr. Tri-WF world tag champions in the 70s. Right. They held it, you know, almost, I think the Samoans often seek a beat that in the 80s, but in the 70s, there was no touching Tanaka and Fuji as a tag team there.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what happened. And he pulled it off and he drew a big crowd and he didn't have to give any refunds. And then it just.
But he got in trouble big time with the commission. And then the whole thing. What was the deal with Buddy Rose, who got on the mic, a hot mic?
Okay, that was another really interesting night. So Rose and Roy Scheider had big heat. Rose was accusing Roy of not paying enough and that Rose was a bigger draw, la ta ta. So in the dressing room, Rose says to me, I'm going to give me the mic. I want to say a few things. And I said, well, let me check with Roy. And he's saying, no, don't check with Roy. I'm just telling you, just give me the mic if I get in the ring. And Roy was in the other room. I don't know what conversation they had. So I said to Rose, look, Roy signs my check. He's not telling me any of this. I consider him a friend. If you're going to come in the ring, you make it look like I'm trying not to give you the mic. Push me, grab it, do whatever. And so there, sure enough, Buddy Rose comes in the ring, taking the mic. Roy Scheider, you're stiffing all the wrestlers. I keep walking away with the mic, and then he grabs it and pushes me. And so that part went well. And then apparently police, I don't know if Roy called local police to come.
Yeah, that's what Roy told me he did.
Yes. And they thought this whole thing is a part of the show. It's all a work. You know, they're not going to get involved. So that kind of backfired. And he really knocked Roy. He said, you're stiffing us on the pay. And people come out to see me. And on he went. And I'm just standing there, you know, listening. The fans are booing. And I see Roy way in the back. So that was a kind of a wild night.
But Buddy was the U.S. champ then.
Yes.
And what I heard, I wasn't there that night, was that he almost came out of the fans' seats. It didn't look like he was coming straight down from the dressing room. Is that your recollection, that he like came out of nowhere, Buddy?
I don't recall that. I don't think I noticed at what point did he pop up and get in the ring. I don't think I remember on the Pat Patterson's book, talking about the Cow Palace, one thing he said that he's right. He said that of all the arenas he's wrestled all over the world, the Cow Palace is the longest distance from the dressing room to the ring. You got to go up about 18 steps to get into the dressing room, for one thing. So you're going down 18 steps. And to walk that huge Cow Palace, to walk halfway through the arena to the ring, he was totally right when he said that. It's a hell of a long.
But
a
so long how did run. How did Andre pull that? Because even in the 70s, walking stairs was difficult for Andre.
He did it. Yeah. Sacramento also had stairs, but maybe 12. Two flights of stairs in Sacramento to get to the dressing room. And Cow Palace had two dressing rooms on opposite ends.
And so it was crazy. They weren't even big. They, you know, they were kind of
right. They did have showers. You know, a lot of those smaller venues don't even have showers. So they can't shower when they're done wrestling. They just got to bring in a couple towels. But Cow Palace was pretty good, you know, for that time. But there were two separate dressing rooms. So he would send the women to the other dressing room and the guys here. And the heels, if you remember, would walk down the left aisle. And the babies would come down the other aisle routinely. So you know which one was a baby face, which one was a heel.
You know, I think Roy used women more than even Mike LaBelle in Los Angeles. Roy, and he, I think he pretty much exclusively used Moolah's girls, you know, like Donna Cresciantello and Tony Rose and Vicki Williams, those great names.
But it was Sandy Parker and a little bit newer generation, Sandy Parker and Donna, a couple others. Lee Lanikai is a name I remember.
Yeah, yeah.
And whenever Andre or the women or the midgets, anything different like that, all those small towns, Stockton, Sacramento, they would pack. They just love seeing something different.
So let me ask you, though, and then I'm going to ask Russ, who would you consider, though, in Roy's territory to be actual draws, meaning anytime they were on a card like Andre, you knew you were going, you could perhaps up the ticket price, but you knew the attendance was going to go up. So let's say Andre, do you think women and midgets, so I'm going to say it's a given, Ray and Pat. But
yes. The two wrestlers.
Say women, midgets, any other stars that it was a guarantee they were going to raise
attendance? I think Andre truly was the greatest draw when Andre the Giant was in town. Roy, and he would often stay. Patterson had his nice house in Redwood City with a pool and a view. I was there a couple times. He would have Davey Rosenberg, the publicist, over. He'd have people at the house all the time. And that's where Andre would stay. And, of course, they both spoke French quite a bit. So there was that real good inn. But whenever Andre was, Roy would always try to get him to stay for 2 weeks, do Sacramento, do San Jose, do the whole territory for 2 weeks and then take off. So he tried to do that. When he was able to do that, every single one of those venues was packed.
Oh, that's fantastic. So
Battle Royals were always a big draw, a Battle Royal. He wouldn't give Louis Miller, he felt like Louis Miller was a little bit competition running Oakland, Richmond, so close to the Cow Palace. But one time he said, Louis, I'll give you a 10-man battle royal, you know, and that packed. Battle royals would pack. Six-man tag matches seemed to draw.
Hey, but Louis wasn't competition. Louis's running Roy's shows just in a closer proximity in Oakland. And
we,
you know,
know that, but that's how Roy felt. And he didn't want to give Louis the best talent. He wanted to save it for the Cow Palace. Like he told me, the Cow Palace is the plum. Just think that way. The Cow Palace is number one.
So what I wanted to know is one of your secrets to announcing. How do you, because you do have that wrestling announcing voice. How do you get into that voice? Yes. How do you get into that voice?
Well, it's not easy when you have 2-3 nights in a row. I can see where some of the singers, you know, in Vegas, they used to do 2 shows a night. I remember seeing Diana Ross, my favorite. 8 o'clock dinner show and then the 12 midnight show. And each show is about an hour and 15 minutes. You wonder, how do they have to have an off night where they lose their voice a little bit or, but just, it's just practice. Just don't ever lose it.
Absolutely. Was there a secret to like how you would get like your projection and how you would like, was there a certain part of the audience you would always target to make sure that they got your voice or something like that?
Not really. It depends on the venue. Sometimes a small venue is more difficult than a big, huge Cow Palace. Because the big Cow Palace, you know the numbers are there, but you don't really see their faces. You don't really see. You look up in the audience. When you're at a small venue, it's kind of like eye-to-eye contact. It's a little bit tougher, I would say. A small venue like Modesto or, you know, even some of Roland's shows, some of them were smaller. Maybe 400, 500, 600 people.
Yeah, oh, well, we had our 100, you know, person shows. Thank God you weren't there in some of those, the bomb scares. But what was the biggest show that you ever announced at?
Probably the Cow Palace Battle Royal each January. We knew that would pack. I sold out the programs. I never could learn. I should have brought 500 more. You know, and I would announce, slight delay, fans, packed crowd, the traffic is a mess, give us 10 minutes, fans. He'd always start about 20 minutes late, you know, just to kind of get them going, always. And the fans would start stomping their feet.
Yep, you know? I remember that every time.
And tell us about your real estate business and how long you've been running that for.
Yeah, that's where I am now. After Roy kind of closed the territory, I says, well, I need to do a little something else. For some reason, I got my real estate license and I hooked up with a broker in Albany, where my house is. And to this date, this has been about 37 years ago, to this date, our office is in the big tower right off 80. There's a big 17-story tower right near Berkeley, Albany, right off 80. The only tower, the next one is not till Sacramento. And this building had this a big banner saying, if you lived here, you'd be home now.
Yes, I'm trying to buy that a lot.
Yeah, people still remember that. So
Alan, let me ask about the Albany, though, and then keep going. Yeah. Did they get rid of my favorite Barnes & Noble that was in Albany? Is that gone now?
Yes. Yeah, it's gone. Oh, and you and I have had lunch several times in Albany, Mike.
Yep.
We've met up here a couple times. Yeah, I was born and raised here, and I really love it. Right near Berkeley. Easy to get to the city.
You're still in the same house, right?
Yes.
After all these decades, the house we were all at.
I love it. Yeah, I bought a house across the street about 30 years ago as a rental, thank God. So that tripled. So that's all good. I was going to retire about 3 years ago. Then COVID came and I thought, well, I can't really travel. So I'm still here. I need to find a real good broker to take over because we do property management. I can't just walk away. So I'm kind of working on that now.
Nice. So can you tell me, because you have been in the Bay Area your whole life and done wrestling your whole life, what do you think sets the Bay Area apart from other territories? Because last week we had we did a Portland Northwest sort of regional thing. So what do you feel is like a thing that sets Bay Area wrestling apart?
Geographically, we have a very good location. You know, when Shire promoted, he would put most of the wrestlers in Hayward. Geographically, that was the best location for Fresno, San Jose, Sacramento, Cal Palace. So geographically, we have a whole, that's a good thing. And the Bay Area is very diversified, as you know. I always kind of thought LA's territory was a little bit better, really. LA, all the other towns they would run outside of outside of Los Angeles. And of course, the history with the Olympic Auditorium, as they're calling it, 18th and Grand. Tremendous history there.
Yeah, but the Cal Palace was bigger. I mean, yeah, those were my home-based venues. The Cal Palace was bigger. It had a more fabulous forum feel to it as a spectacular building, you know, for the Grand Nationals. You know, and whereas LaBelle had San Diego, he had Pete Collins running San Diego, and he had Bakersfield, San Bernardino, Ventura County, El Monte, which Jeff Walton ran. Roy, though, you look at the breadth of that because he had Reno for X period of time. Yeah. Swensky doing San Jose,
Vegas.
Stockton, Modesto, Sacramento, the partnership with Vegas. Now, when did Vegas start? Later 70s, right?
Or much later, toward the end. Victor Barry and I, in fact, before Victor left, he would bring me with him. We'd fly to Vegas, so I would help sell programs and do all that kind of stuff before I started announcing. So I remember being in Vegas when it was hard, nothing like it is now. I don't know if either of you have been to Vegas recently, but it is packed from the airport all the way to old downtown. Unbelievable.
Fremont Street. Was that what venue did Roy run in Vegas? Do you remember?
I know that when Vern Gagne came in, he ran out the Showboat, and they had TV going out of the Showboat. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Reno, I remember the venue was called the Shy Clown Hotel and Casino. In Vegas, in fact, yes, it was he ran at the convention center, the Las Vegas Convention Center.
Okay, that might have been the precursor to the Thomas and Mack Center, which is a much bigger convention center where wrestling is run now. Let me ask, as we're winding down a bit, and Russ will have some more questions, in terms of like memorabilia, and you may not have that at your real estate office now. What are some of your prized memorabilia the 60s and 70s?
I thought of bringing some of that. I have a ton of posters still. Richmond Auditorium, Stockton. I must have a ton of those. I have every program that I did for the Cal Palace. Maybe if we do this again, I'll bring some here and hold them up. I've got a lot of good posters. I put a couple of pictures of them on Facebook, but I don't as much as I should. But I have the program with Andre the Giant and a six-man tag at Stockton Auditorium, Patterson, Andre, and somebody else. I have some of the old photos, Kenji Shibuya, pictures from Channel 2 Wrestling. I don't have a huge amount, but the posters and the programs. I do have a lot of the magazines that I wrote for from the 70s and 80s.
Oh, let me ask this, because Alan was unique, Russ, also making different programs for the different cities, but your Action Wrestling magazine was, I think, the longest, best wrestling program, because it was many, many pages long, stories, photos. Yeah. Whereas most, like if you look at Vince McMahon Sr.'s thing, it was one piece of paper, glossy paper, folded in half, so it had four sides. That was his program. Alan Bolte produced a program that was often 28, 30-plus pages long, you know, a real magazine.
And the new issue came out with every Cow Palace. That was where the new... I remember one time I had sold the same programs, so I took the Cow Palace program early and sold it in Sacramento 3 days before the Cow Palace, and it got back to Roy, and he had a fit. That's what he went on about. The Cow Palace is a plum. First, think of the Cow Palace first.
Now, is there any kind of an online archive of these magazines, or?
No, there was a website, Kayfabe Memories, and I did a lot of real, you know, stories for them, real things that happened, and shoots and stuff like that. But I don't think there really is. I keep in touch with Jim Fitzpatrick. You remember him?
Oh, yeah, the roller derby, right?
Yes. Right. So he, and, you know, roller derby tried to make a bit of a comeback, and it just didn't quite.
One of the co-promoters with Jim, and then they became enemies, Tim Patton, passed away. He was kind of very heavy, about 400 pounds. He was really instrumental. I went to a lot of those, and he would have, half of them would be like legendary roller derby and roller games people. Like he'd bring up Honey Sanchez from the T-Birds and Skinny Minnie Gwen Miller and Ronnie Washington and all these guys. But he would have the derby folks, and then he'd try to indoctrinate some young kids. So it was a nice mix, and it just kind of stopped. You know, they had, for 2 years in a row, they had like 2 weeks of roller derby just about 10 years ago at the Pleasanton County Fair, Russ. And they brought the real true bank track. It wasn't like the flat track a lot of these.
You never know when something like that will come back in as a fad. But no, I would hope maybe some of those incredible, you know, newsletters and programs that you wrote up could somehow survive, you know, for the next generation if they care so much to, because it's a lot of great history there.
But leave it up to Alan, because that's Alan's legal intellectual property. If that Alan wants to put it up. But what I hate these fans. They call themselves historians, which is bullshit. And they put up people's video, and then they credit it to themselves. They had nothing to do with it, and nor have they asked. They don't know if it's still copyrighted. The copyright's been maintained. Yes. So if Alan were to do it, Russ, that would be great if he chose to put up his work. But we'd want to make sure Alan was fully credited. This is his content. Yeah. This is his creative process.
About that down the road. You know, you're mentioning about the roller derby. Do you remember in its heyday, you had the LA Thunderbirds, the New York Chiefs, the Bay Bombers. I mean, you had all these in and out all over the country. Really successful.
But the difference between roller games is those teams were all fictitious. The New York, whatever the team was called, they did not play in New York. They just were all based in L.A., satellite little cities. And when another team, the Jersey Devils, it would just be people stationed in L.A., whereas roller derby, Jerry Seltzer's based out of San Francisco, Oakland.
Yes.
They were legit teams that would skate, and they'd be baby faces in their territory. The Bay Bombers would go there. They'd be the heels. So that was more legit, like a real, like Major League Baseball or something, or the NFL.
Yeah, exactly. But they had a lot of teams, the Chicago Red Devils, and, you know, on and on it went. But I also heard that the part of the problem, the setting up the roller derby track, the rink.
No, it took forever, and it was expensive.
Yes, took forever and was much more than setting up a wrestling ring.
That's one benefit. And sometimes you don't even need a ring. You know, some of these guys will go crazy. Now, have you announced?
Let me also throw in, I also announced what they called Incredibly Strange Wrestling, which
right.
Mike saw some of that. That was very big. We were packing the Fillmore, like every other month.
Oh, you did that for years. The weird thing was Audra McDonald, I think that was her name.
Audra.
Johnny Legend came up and brought it. He was the one that came up with it in Los Angeles. His sister, Lynn Margulies, was fiance to Andy Kaufman. She went to the San Francisco Academy of Art, which was right next door to my medical practice at 450 Sutter in downtown San Francisco. But anyway, he brings up Incredibly Strange Wrestling, which is, you know, he has Lucha Libre, you know, Lucha movies in the background. He has, you know, the crazy wrestlers, but he brought legit wrestlers. Like, that's where the guy, the Samoan that died that used to do the thumb thrust, that's where he started as a teenager, Russ. Okay. He was on those. And then Audra, like, stole it and kept calling it Incredibly Strange Wrestling. But she was very successful. She was a better marketeer than Johnny Legend was. And Johnny, you know, kept saying, oh, I should sue her, but he never did. And she had that going for years. She came up with the thing of throwing tortillas at the boys.
Yes. And she's very well versed in San Francisco. She has a lot of connections. She's very good with publicity and such. And she used a lot of the pro wrestlers. Johnny Payne, Psycho Johnny Payne, my good friend, worked for her as well as in the...
Lay Emperor, that's where Tom started. Lay Emperor started there.
There's another one. Good.
Yeah, I came and shot those. Those were a lot of fun. And you did the commentary. What was the guy's name who's an author? Something Barry?
Count Dante. It was the other... He was the heel announcer. I was the baby announcer. And he did a book on...
The karate thing. Deadliest Arts.
But your Incredibly Strange Wrestling was unique in that you guys, they put it over the loudspeaker so the fans could hear you guys. Whereas most wrestling, you didn't hear what the announcers were saying. But this, it was on a... Amplified.
Yeah, we did color commentating live at the show. Yeah. Interesting. Audra still has Jerry Monty's wrestling ring. Shire had that ring 16 by 16. She argued it's 18 by 18. I don't think so. That's what he used in the TV studio for all Channel 2 and Channel 40. Very easy to take up and down in 1 hour. Audra still has it. She was going to sell it to Kirk White, and then that kind of fell through. So she still has that ring.
You know who she bought it from? She bought it from Jerry Monty's mistress, Edwina Burns. Yes. And when Jerry died, Edwina had it. Audra gets it, but she never did sell it. And some one of the big, tall workers for BTW built Kirk his own ring, what I was told.
Yes, right. So Audra still has that ring in her.
But she hasn't promoted wrestling in how many years? Years and years and years.
Right. Yeah.
What a waste. And that's a lot of history right there.
Oh, yeah. And the Fillmore, Incredibly Strange went down a little bit when they lost the Fillmore, because that was a huge venue. And ever since then, she kept moving it. She moved it to a nightclub, to here, to there. And the Fillmore didn't want it because of all the tortillas, and it was a mess to clean up. But eventually, they just said, this is not for us. But Audra had a good 3 years at the Fillmore.
I had photos in the Bay Guardian and the East Bay Express of the aftermath. You'd see like a million tortillas and trash all over the floor. And that is a historic Fillmore West. That was a pretty historic, right on Gary at the Fillmore. Historic venue, you know.
Still there. And in fact, the Rock's Boz Skaggs is making a comeback. And he's going to be doing a couple shows there next month. So it's still there and still drawing quite well.
Doesn't he still own one of the clubs, the music clubs in San Francisco?
Slim's,
Slim.
Audra ran some shows at Slim's toward the end. Yeah, but it just, eventually, it ran its course, as we said.
You know what? Before we let you go, I remember Audra had an ISW show on the... that punk tour, and it was down at the Embarcadero outside, and you were the ring announcer.
I announced. Huge.
That was huge.
She wanted me to go on tour, and I said, I've got too much going on here. They ran a whole bunch of places across the country.
It was like a tennis shoe company, and they would do these annual rock concerts, and she got her way in there and put on these shows. It was good for the boys.
And they did very well.
Yeah. Well, so have you announced your final match yet, or you still, you know, could do one more? Your voice sounds great.
I still have it. When we lost Kirk White, which I was very sorry about that, I never knew his wife, but for some reason...
She was a saint then, but she has done Alan wrong and not continually using him. Why wouldn't you want the voice of BTW, yeah, for good or bad, whether you liked or disliked Kirk? Yeah. The voice of BTW is Alan Bolte.
Yeah, 22 years. Announced for them 22 years. The announcer before me, his name was Ron Head, I believe. He had kind of gimmicky announcer. But
I like Ron. He's a fun guy.
Yeah, okay.
But he's been out of the business a long time. The weird thing was he, Jeff Benson, J.R. Benson, and Cornette's current wife, Stacy Goff, who was a valet, she started out learning bumps at APW. She did the lesbian angle where they replicated ECW's thing with her and Miss Gina. Yeah. Carla Filbert was her real name. But they, Stacy Goff, not Brenda, her sister, Ron Head, Jeff Benson, they all decided when Cornette started up Smoky Mountain, we're going to move back, and Cornette is, or OVW, where Cornette's going to give us work. And he did have Ron Head do announcing for a little while, but I don't know whatever happened to them along with their videographer, for which is Peter Hines. So the only one left standing out of all of them, I don't hear Ron Head's name anymore. I hope someone can disprove that, because Ron, you know, Ron did his shticky comedic announcing, not like
he's
Alan.
He's a nice guy when I met him.
He was a good friend of mine, because they did an offshoot of Johnny Legend's Wrestling called Extremely Strange Wrestling, not Incredibly. Oh. And they would go, they had a commissioner, they had it as like a poor man's ECW. They had a commissioner who was a San Francisco street person, a legit San Francisco street person, and they would film these vignettes with him. They'd tell him what to say in advance. But, you know, the guy was out of it. But so Stacy Goff becomes Jim Cornette's wife. She's the only one that came, you know, became a big deal and survives to this day in wrestling.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the best things that you did, Mike, was, and I know you had a bit of a run-in with Kirk over the whole thing, when he brought Patterson in for the Fan Fest.
He asked me to nag Pat. Pat had never done a convention before, and so I had the connection to Pat, who had kept telling Kirk no. So I got him to do it, because X amount of years, Kirk White had paid me $150, which was nothing, to do all his PR. Free TV on Channel 4 with Gary Redd.
What I was going to say, you got Pat on Channel 7 news, on the radio stations. You did so much for him that whole weekend, and the place was packed.
Every year he only got the wrestlers on, what was the ESPN affiliate in San Francisco, the big mega one? The Sports Leader, KNBR, I got those deals for Kirk every single year. I would get Brett on 3-4 times, because I would go in with him. And then I got Piper on, and I got Pat on. Piper twice, Honky Tonk Man, some of the other ones. But that very last one, the last Fan Fest that I got Pat to agree to come in for Kirk for the Fan Fest, and Pat sang karaoke there. Kirk stiffed me on the $150 that he fucking owed me. I went off on him, and that's when the heat started with Kirk White.
I know.
For stiffing me, he couldn't even buy that kind of PR. He couldn't buy 50,000-watt ESPN station in San Francisco.
You had him on everything.
And the newspaper. I even got him a couple of in my column in the Examiner, but some blurbs in the Chronicle, which is the more prestigious newspaper in Northern California.
I always like to give a quick little Pat Patterson quote. Let's go have a drink or 10.
Yeah.
Keep it off.
That's great.
Wait. I've got this one. Bully Ray, Bubba Ray Dudley, always says in WWF time, when Pat was Vince's number two, he would, when something really went over, or like Hogan came out there, or John Cena and the crowd popped, Pat would go, the place went banana.
Yeah.
Do you remember Pat ever saying that?
Yeah.
Place went banana.
Every other word, Gorilla Monsoon, it was two things. Oh, give me a break. Or the other thing Monsoon would always say, oh, please.
Yeah, would you please? Would you please? Anyway, we're winding up. We're at the end of the hour, if you can believe it.
Okay,
Russ, that many years of not being in touch, we're finally in touch again.
Mike, a pleasure. We go way
back. Alan's one of my best friends. I mean, Alan and I have been friends probably even longer than Evan Ginsberg and myself. So we go back so far, and I really was appreciative that Alan, after, you know, X period of time, particularly when I moved up to the Bay Area to go to dental school, he wrote, Mike Leno is the exclusive photographer for his program, Action Wrestling Magazine.
No, you know, you were, when we did a show and I knew you were going to be announcing on the card, I knew it was going to be a great show.
Good.
You know, thank you, Russ.
I will, if you want to do something again, I will
bring some pictures
and some programs and stuff.
We do. We do.
Yeah. We need to talk about Gary Keyser. There's so much.
Oh, yeah.
Bruce Sasaki. Alan is a storefront, a historian of Bay Area knowledge.
So we'll get back to that.
Gary was so over. And I was the one that started calling the Godfather. I just kind of came out with that out of nowhere. And he says, I like that, you know. But I always told him, Keyser, he would sit when he was manager with the Von Brauners. He would sit on the ring steps, which is like 2 feet from me at the press table. And people would throw oranges and they throw stuff and they try. And I says, don't sit on the other side.
Don't sit so close. So how would anybody get a hold of you through social media if they wanted to get in touch with you?
My email address, keyfabe@aol.com/keyfabe. Just know I'm not kayfabing the kayfabe. That is the email address.
You said that Rocky Johnson screwed up the spelling of that for you.
He got the kayfabe is spelled K-A-Y-F-A-B-E. And he grabbed that first, right when I was looking for email addresses. So I took K-E-Y, which is second.
That's what I thought.
A funny, quickly, Rocky Johnson story. I remember they had a Richmond Auditorium. They had a huge dairy in those days, Royal Jersey Dairy. I took my mother. We went to the dairy, shopping, buying all stuff. And the guy says, aren't you the wrestling announcer? I say, yeah, that's me at the Cow Palace. Well, do you know Rocky Johnson? I said, well, of course. He's one of the big name wrestlers. Well, next time you see him, tell him he bounced a check here.
Yeah. Think you can pay with interest now.
And who would have thought? I always watched The Rock when he was a kid, sitting on mother's lap at the Cow Palace. And who'd have thought he would have grown up to be this huge wrestler and star that he is, The Rock. I mean,
it's really amazing. Really amazing stuff. We've been in the center of a lot of greatness
here
in the Bay Area. And it's glad that you were a part of it and glad you're a part of what made my experience great.
Well, look at all the guys that Pat, once he got up there, and he was very close to Vince Jr., even as early as 78, 79, he brought in Rocky Johnson, Don Morocco. He brought Fuji back, but he with The Office, right. Snuka, Buddy Rose, that was all, and Ray Stevens, it was all because Pat Patterson.
Yeah, very true.
There's a guy we miss, nicest guy and class guy, and could sing a damn great, you know, Sinatra impersonation.
He was wild, but he was always a lot of fun to go out with. He always had a good time, you know, and he loved the business too. I mean, Pat did extremely well, and Vince just thought the world of him with his wrestling mind and his ideas.
But I think he took all of that from Pat learned at the foot of Roy Shire. He took him. And Vern Gagne, so he took all that knowledge, and Eddie Graham, all the people he worked for, and that's why he was so valuable to Vince, because, man, you have all these great booking minds all in one person.
Amazing. And he and Roy had quite a falling out. Pat wanted to buy the territory, and Roy wasn't ready now. And that's kind of where they parted their ways. And then Pat left and went on to much bigger things. And, we miss Pat. He lived a good life. He worked hard and he partied hard, you know.
he's quite the legend out here. Anyway, we're out of time for this week, but it's really been great catching up with you after all this time. And
thank you, guys. On the show again. I'd love to come back.
Yeah, let's bring Alan back because we just scratched the surface on history.
So, and as we always say, see you at ringside.
Absolutely. Or as John Swinski would say, kids, get away from the ring.
Come on, kids. Get away from that damn ring. And here's how John Swinski would introduce in the red corner, Pepe Gomez.
No inflection, nothing.
And then this, Joe Potkaiser, ring the bell. Joe, ring the bell.
Wow. Well, Alan, it's great to see you again. Have fun. Thank you for being on the show. And we'll have you on again soon. Good night, everyone. See you next week.
Good night, guys. Good night, Alan. Thank you.